stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with another Chicago actor, also starring in My Fair Lady at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. This is Joel Hatch, who's playing Colonel Pickering, and who, according to Sharon Leslie's review, is, as Colonel Pickering, anchoring the show. Joel's is a very interesting story, as for most of his early life, he was sure he was headed for a religious life and wound up being a musical comedy performer. I'm also playing a song from the show that's from the original production, the song that Colonel Pickering sings, which is You Did It. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about self-discovery. If you've been listening, you know that I believe that we all come out of childhood in denial, actually in ignorance, of some things about ourselves. As a psychotherapist, I have seen over and over again people wanting to do things, to be things, to have qualities that they already have, but which they had to suppress because it didn't work, or didn't get them what they wanted, and it may even have gotten them something they didn't want, like neglect or even trauma. So the taboo against surfacing these qualities is really strong. However, I believe that surfacing these qualities is what allows for us to have the fullest life we can. So if as a child you had a temper tantrum and you learned unequivocally that that was not going to be acceptable, perhaps you don't know how to do anger. Perhaps you don't even know when you're feeling angry. Now, of course, it's not rocket science. because you're not feeling it doesn't mean that it isn't happening inside your body and your body's taking a toll for it. But still, there are lots of people who say, well, I just don't get angry. I just don't do anger. So, you know, I think that recognizing when you are angry, being able to begin to express it, is not only a good thing for you interpersonally, but is also a good thing for your body. So the Lynn Show is all about recognizing, considering the possibility that there are things about you that you suppressed, denied, and that it is possible for you to recover them and have access to them and use them. To learn more about this, you might want to go to my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. There you can have access to the book that I wrote, When You Can, You Will. You can even hear a little bit of it, a little bit of the audiobook at my website. And you can hear all of the interviews that I do. And that's the other thing I do in the show. I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist, where I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because in order to do that in this culture, it really has to be who you are. And so the people I interview are, at least in their work, congruent. That's the psychotherapeutic term for what you hear is what you got, somebody who is in sync with themselves. Today, I'm interviewing Chicago actor Joel Hatch, who is here in Sarasota, Florida, appearing as Colonel Pickering in the Oslo Repertory Theater production of My Fair Lady. And Joel's interview is particularly interesting because he didn't embrace his life in theater, which is so clearly who he is, until he was, well, out of college for a year. It's an interesting story, and particularly interesting for me because it makes the point that one does not have to have this, you know, first thing out of the box, that one can come to it later in life. Before I play the interview with Joel, I'm going to play a song from the film version of My Fair Lady. This is the song that he, Joel, sings with Jeff Parker in the production of My Fair Lady. But the version you're going to hear is Robert Coote and Rex Harrison from the film version of My Fair Lady. And so now I'm going to play that song, and then I'm going to follow it with my interview with Joel Hatch.
Tonight, old man, you did it, you did it, you did it. You said that you would do it, and indeed you did. I thought that you would rue it, I doubted you'd do it. But now I must admit it, and succeed you did. You should get a medal or be even made a knight.
It was nothing, really nothing.
All alone you hurdled every obstacle in sight.
Now wait, now wait, give credit where it's due. A lot of the glory goes to you.
But you're the one who did it, who did it, who did it. As sturdy as Gibraltar, not a second did you falter. There's no doubt about it, you did it. I must have aged a year tonight. At times I thought I'd die of fright. Never was there a momentary lull.
Shortly after we came in, I saw at once we'd easily win. And after that I found it deadly dull.
You should have heard the oohs and ahs, everyone wondering who she was.
You think they'd never seen a lady before.
And when the Prince of Transylvania asked to meet her and gave his arm to lead her to the floor, I said to him, you did it, you did it, you did it. They thought she was ecstatic and so damned aristocratic, and they never knew that you did it.
Thank heavens for Zoltan Kapathi. If he hadn't been there, I'd have died of boredom. Yes, he was there all right and up to his old tricks.
Kapathi, that dreadful Hungarian, was he there?
Yes.
That blackguard who uses the science of speech more to blackmail and swindle than teach. He made it the devilish business of his to find out who this Miss Doolittle is. Every time we looked around, there he was, that hairy hound from Budapest. Never leaving us alone, never have I ever known a ruder pest. Finally, I decided it was foolish not to let him have his chance with her. So I stepped aside and let him dance with her. Oozing charm from every pore, he oiled his way around the floor. Every trick that he could play, he used to strip her mask away. And when at last the dance was done, he glowed as if he knew he'd won. And with a voice too eager and a smile too broad, he announced to the hostess that she was a fraud!
No!
Yuffo! Her English is too good, he said. That clearly indicates that she is foreign. Whereas others are instructed in their native language, English people aren't. And although she may have studied with an expert dialectician and grammarian, I can tell that she was born Hungarian! Not only Hungarian, but of royal blood. She is a princess.
Congratulations, Professor Giggins, for your glorious victory. Congratulations, Professor Giggins, you'll be back on the history.
Let's even try to be a Professor Giggins, in the pool of God and his victory.
Here I am with Joel Hatch, who is Colonel Pickering in My Fair Lady. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Okay.
And clearly you are doing that. Because the question I ask is, how did it happen? How did it start? Not how did you get your first job, but how did you know? When did you know?
Oh, that was a very confused journey. Because I was going to go to the seminary. I was going...
Wait. So from the time you were little, you thought you were going to be a priest?
No, not a priest. I was in the Lutheran church I grew up in.
Then what would you be, a pastor?
A pastor, oh, okay. Yes. And I went to a small liberal arts Lutheran college, had a lot of music background there. And
okay, hold on. Did you sing in the choir?
I sang in the...
Did you sing in the bathtub when you were a boy? Did your parents say, oh, lovely voice? Do you know what I mean?
When I was very little, say when I was around second grade, I sang my first solo with the choir, and I had a pretty voice.
I'm sure, well, yeah. And so even though you were quite young,
yes,
and singing and making a sort of splash with your voice, right? I mean, being known as someone, right? You didn't think of being a performer.
No, because where I grew up was a wide place in the road. I grew up on a farm about 7 miles from a town called Trimont, which is about 800 population, and it was in southern Minnesota, and there was no theater.
Yeah. Was there a movie?
If you drove quite a ways,
wow,
you could go see a movie. I didn't see many movies growing up.
No, clearly.
We got television when I was about second or third grade.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that time, I listened to a lot of classical music because my oldest brother was 12 years older than me and very, very brilliant. And he belonged to Columbia Record Club, and he got all the classics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I
did. Anybody play?
I had an older brother who played piano quite well.
So there was a lot of music, but but not any sense of making it a career or performing.
Not at all. And that was wild. You know, that's what people in New York did, not people on a farm in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And
So there is a journey here from there to... So when was the very first time
I did a couple of musicals, one between my junior and senior year of college.
Oh my God, that was the first one?
Yes, and then, and that was just a community theater thing when I was home working one summer.
And what made you go and audition?
I always knew I could sing. Uh-huh. And I always knew that I did a scene for a class, like when I was a freshman in college, with somebody. And the teacher of the class said, Joel, you know, you should, you know, take some theater classes. And I was like, no, that's not what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to go to the seminary. So I didn't really take it seriously. And then I did a musical while I was home working one summer. And it was Annie, Get Your Gun.
What were you?
I was the male lead. What was mm-hmm. his name? Who
gets lost in her arms.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
And
it's a great show.
It's a great show.
Mm-hmm. And, great score.
You know, he's basically the straight man for her being funny.
Right.
And it was fine. And it showed off my singing, and that was fine. And I had, and it was a lot of fun. And then at my senior year of college, I decided to drop out of the choir because I couldn't finish all of my classes in the four-year span if I stayed in choir, because they toured and I just couldn't. So since I wasn't in choir, I thought, well, I'll try out for the musical. And it was Sound of Music. Mm-hmm. And I went and I auditioned, and they gave me the part of Emile Debeck.
Of course.
And that really, I loved that.
Yes, right.
That was heaven. And so after I got done with college, I went and I worked in a church for a couple of years in northern Minnesota.
Worked in
as a youth counselor.
Mm-hmm. I still hadn't gone into the seminary.
No, it was sort of prep for, uh-huh. you know. And the campus pastor at this little Lutheran college told me, Joel, you know, you should just go work in a church for a couple of years and see, because I don't know, I think he maybe had a suspicion in the back of his mm-hmm. head that...
Smart guy.
That, you know, maybe I'm not totally 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I worked in this church for a couple of years, and I had about 150 high school students that I worked with, great kids. We would take kids into the Boundary Waters for these 10-day trips, you know, and just do all kinds of wonderful things throughout the year. And we staged a Godspell with them and, you know, all kinds of fun stuff. And a friend of mine who taught English in the high school there said, Joel, I'm starting this little opera company called the Masabra Opera Company. We got a State Arts Council grant. And we're gonna produce Marta by von Flotow. And he said, I'd like you to be the baritone in it. There's two couples, a tenor and soprano and a baritone and mezzo couple. And I said, oh, that'd be fun. So that worked with my schedule, and I did that. And I thought, I really like this a lot. And by the end of the 2 years, I realized that I liked what I was doing with the kids a lot, but I thought the pastor's job was the hardest job I could ever imagine. I had a great deal of respect for the man, but I thought his job was impossible.
And what did you see about it that struck you as...
Well, there's this interesting cycle that people go through in which they would come into him for marriage counseling after the holidays.
Yeah, right.
And they would hate each other and want to get divorced, and then they do marriage counseling through the winter months. And then they go away to the cabin, and they come back to the fall, and they were very devout, and then by they got done through the holidays, they hated
they
each other
again.
And I thought to myself, I think I'd go out of my mind if I...
That's great.
To deal with the same thing over and over year after year.
Right, right.
It's the same cycle. And you just know everything about everybody, and that's too much information. Mm-hmm. I got depressed thinking about all
yeah.
that.
And what's so interesting is that the one thing was diminishing while the other thing was growing.
Yeah, Yeah, and I something I realized was whatever it was that I wanted to do for a career, I should really enjoy the drudgery job of it. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy taking a script apart and studying it. Mm-hmm. Before I ever see an audience.
I was going to say, it's not all about being on stage for you.
Oh, real fun stuff. Mm-hmm. Many times the most exciting, most emotional moments mm-hmm. are just moments in a rehearsal room mm-hmm.
yeah.
with a couple of chairs and a table.
Yeah, making the thing,
yeah.
building it, creating it.
Experiencing it for the first time. That's the really fun work. The hard work is recreating
that
moment.
Yeah. Acting is so hard. I think acting is so hard. For precisely that, mm-hmm. you know, that you have to find it in yourself over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not a spontaneous thing. It's
not at all.
No. People don't know. So here you are. I find this absolutely fascinating. We have this young man who for all of his life, pretty much, has thought that a religious life really is going to be his life.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's forced essentially to discover that the religious life doesn't appeal nearly as much as he thought it did. And this other thing is really compelling and appealing.
Mm-hmm.
There must have been moments when you struggled with that.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
I mean, talk about the ridiculous to the sublime to the ridiculous or something like that, right?
Well, there's also things that were feeding it. I was having disagreements, not necessarily with the church I was working in, but the church as a whole.
Uh-huh. And with a capital C.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had a kid that I was working with who was confused about his sexuality,
mm-hmm.
and at that time in the early 80s, the church was telling me the big, you know, I'd go to these retreats where they'd, you know, work with us as counselors, and they would say, you know, we have a psychiatrist who can de-gay them.
They can fix them.
Yeah,
right.
And I
de-gay
go,
them? Did they really say
I don't, that? No, but that was what they were talking
yeah,
about.
Right.
And I was going, I think that's a really frightening, awful thing to do to this kid. And I went back to the pastor at the church I was working at, and he's a wise man. He said, you know, what do I say to this kid? And he said, tell him that God loves him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what we say to everybody.
Right.
You know, we're all
God's children.
Yes.
Right.
And, but I was having problems with what the
yeah.
major body was, how they were dealing with certain things. They've come a long way since then.
Yes, well.
But at the time, I was young and I didn't have the patience to deal with that.
Well, and again, it you had a competing force, you know?
Yes, I did.
You know, so, I mean, it wasn't so simple.
Yeah.
I don't know. It would have been interesting if you had had this struggle and nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
But you had somewhere else to go.
Yes, and it might have been, I don't know, it might have been even a stronger decision if I hadn't had somewhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been a much more dramatic decision
if
I had. But I did have somewhere else to go. And the I contacted the University of Minnesota the second year I was at this parish, and I asked them, you have a professional graduate program in acting, an MFA program. And I said, how do you get into that program? And they said, it's by audition only. I said, so I don't have to have, like,
a
whole body of theater background?
Wow.
And they said, no, it's audition only.
Wow.
Because it's a professional program and not an academic program. And I said, okay. And I said, when is this audition? And then I worked for, you know, several months developing a piece. What was it? One was from Last of the Red Hot Lovers, I think, was Neil Simon. And it was my comedy modern. And then there was from Henry IV, Part 2, the King's Speech that ends with, uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. Mm-hmm. Because even though I was in my 20s, I was already character man. So,
and when you say you worked on it, do you mean that you took acting lessons, or you just read it and did it?
I asked a teacher who taught Shakespeare in high school, mm-hmm. if he could help me.
And he did.
And he did. And then I asked the teacher who I'd also worked with at the opera, who directed the high school plays, if he could help me with the comedy piece. And he did on that. And I went down to the University of Minnesota, and there were all these people there, you know.
I know, who'd been doing this since they were two,
yes.
right? Who'd been in every play in
high
school.
They'd done 100 different shows.
Yeah, right.
And they'd say, how many have you done? I'd say, 3.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was a stretch.
Yeah.
right.
And then I auditioned, and I was one of the 12 that was selected
wow.
to get into that.
Wow, that must have felt great.
It was kind of mind-blowing. The best thing is I didn't really know what I was doing, so I didn't feel like all these people all know so much more than me.
Yeah.
If I'd spent
you
a lot...
You didn't know how much there was to know.
Yes.
yes, I
got
so
it. I sort of walked in with a certain bravado, mm-hmm. you know, of
and
the...
And an innocence.
An innocence uh-huh. that, you know, so... I guess I wasn't as nervous as I should have been.
Well, yes, I think that's probably right, but it all worked for you. It's
it
wonderful.
Did. It did.
So, you haven't mentioned your family at all. I mean, I have this fantasy of this family that thought they were going to get a pastor and then they got a thespian.
Yeah, well, actually, my parents were incredibly supportive of me. My mother was...
Are you the baby boy? You
yes.
keep talking about older siblings?
3 older brothers.
Uh-huh. Oh, so baby boy.
And extremely baby boy because they were all like 12, 8, and 6 years older than me.
Oh, wait. You know, they say if there's more than, I think, 7 years between you, you're an only child.
Kinda. Right. I was. I mean, they were all out of high school by the time I got into high school.
Oh, so they must have loved you.
My feet never touched the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was, you know.
Right.
I had a lot of security in myself.
Yeah, right. And it shows in all of this.
Yeah.
You know, your ability to do that turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
It did require a lot of ego strength, I think, to say, wait a minute. And I know I thought this was what I was going to do, but maybe, you know, not everybody can do that.
I think a lot of people end up at the end of their life going,
damn.
I didn't do anything that I really wanted to do.
I think that's exactly right.
And so I think I've been extremely, extremely lucky.
Yeah, I do too. Parenthetically, the theme of the Lynn Show is precisely that most people come into adulthood with ideas about themselves that are not the whole truth and are never really able to find the mm-hmm. truth. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because in order to do that in our culture, you have to be someone who is just who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be who you are or you can't survive what we do to artists in this
mm-hmm.
culture.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a perfect example of that. You know, the ego strength to say at a point where most people are already launched into their career with no questions about it and no willingness or ability to say, is this right, you know? She did this 180 turnaround.
And my mother, of course, said, you know, there is a certain element in theater. And I said, Mother, I've been working with a certain element in the church that I think is far more frightening. And
Wow. And
my father said, it could have been worse, you could have gone into farming. Which
you didn't say that we're comedians in your family.
He's a funny man. But he that was the wisest thing he could have said.
Yeah, of course. That was great. They were great, both of them. Do you know what the element she meant was?
I don't really know, and I didn't want to know.
I think that was very wise.
Yeah.
Right. Because that was her fear.
Yes.
Right? And you didn't
Well,
know.
I mean, you grow up on the farm, and it's, you know... you know, the theater life is not necessarily a respectable life.
No, absolutely. No, well, you don't have to grow up on a farm to have that in your family, but certainly...
My mother couldn't be prouder of me today. You know, she's 90 now, and she loves what I do. And, you know, and my father, until the day he died, was just as supportive as could be.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got into this school, and you got an MFA, I'm assuming, right? Mm-hmm. And... Minnesota, I mean, it's not the hub of the theater here.
You'd be amazed, though, because actually, Minneapolis, at one time, with all the community theaters they had more theaters per capita than any other city in the United States.
My goodness.
They had a thriving non-professional theater because in the winter...
What else is there to do, right?
So the arts there are extremely
important.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Guthrie is there, which is the largest Lort theater in the country. And the Children's Theater in Minneapolis, which is the largest children's theater in the Western Hemisphere.
Oh, my goodness.
And I started out, and the Minnesota Opera. So I started out, while I was still at the University of Minnesota, I was getting gigs at the Children's Theater and at the Minnesota Opera. And my mentor at the University of Minnesota was the artistic director of the Minnesota Opera, Wesley Balk. And so I did La Cenerentola at Cinderella for him at the Minnesota Opera.
So, okay, so how did you get to Chicago where you apparently settled?
Well, I was married while I was in Minneapolis, while I was finishing up graduate school, and my wife at the time was working in arts administration, and she was offered a position with a company that developed software for arts and entertainment organizations, ticketing, marketing software, and they were based in Madison, Wisconsin. And so we knew that I would have to move away from Minneapolis. So I auditioned down in Chicago. Sort of did one of those weekend sort of drive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had three auditions scheduled, one at the Goodman, one at someplace else, and then also at Marriott Theater, which is a big musical theater house in the Burbs. And the Marriott called me back and asked me if I'd like to come down to do Me and My Girl. So I did that. And that led to quite a few shows down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were based in Madison, and I was commuting back the 150 miles back and forth. I'd stay down there in Chicago for the week, and then I'd go back and back and forth. And then I started touring out of Chicago. The people that created Annie tried to do a sequel called Annie Warbucks, and I ended up going with that out to the West Coast, doing an out-of-town tour, and then we brought it into New York. We did it off-Broadway, and then finally failed there. And by the time I'd been away from home for about a year and a half,
I was just going to say, hard on a marriage.
It was over.
Yeah.
And I came home, and there wasn't
it wasn't
marriage.
There.
No.
Right.
So I'm moved down to Chicago. I remarried an actress in Chicago.
Smart.
Some people say crazy, but I think smart. And we've been doing theater down in Chicago. Not long after we were married, we ended up being both cast in Showboat for Hal Prince. We've been working out of Chicago for the majority of our years. Just moved to New York about 5 years ago. Here's the story. A friend of mine, Josh Schmidt, brilliant, brilliant composer, who does sound design and underscoring of theater pieces all over the country. He said to me, Joel, I'm going to write an opera for you. And I said, that's nice, Josh. And, you know, people say things like this. But then he told me the story that it was based on, and it was based on a play called The Adding Machine. It takes place in a very urban setting, and the major character is named Zero. All the characters have numbers. And he is a precursor to Willie Loman. And I think it's the first great American play.
I read it.
Yeah. And it's a precursor to Eugene O'Neill. It's, mm-hmm. you know, he said this character, Zero, the piece starts out, and he kills his boss, and it's all downhill from there. And he says, and it's really funny. And I went, okay, that sounds very strange. And he said, but we got an idea that it would work nice as a piece of musical theater. And haven't quite made up my mind if it's a musical or an opera yet, but that's what I'm starting to work on. So we did this piece. And
you mean he wrote it?
He wrote it. And a few years later, they did a workshop, but I couldn't be available for it because I was working on another show at the time. And then they were going to produce it at a theater called Next Theater in Evanston, just north of Chicago. And he said, I got this director, David Cromer, and I love David. He's a brilliant, brilliant director, and I've seen his work in Chicago over the years. And he said, we would like you to do this. And so I, you know, it was one of these little tiny theaters. It used to be a grade school auditorium, tiny little place. Very small budget, you know, practically no money. But, you know, old friends, mm-hmm. and you got to do it. So we put this piece up. And it was a big departure from what you normally see in musical theater. And a lot of people had a tough time figuring out if it was opera or musical theater. I think it's musical theater because it's not sung through. And it got a lot of interest in Chicago. And Charles Isherwood from the New York Times was in Chicago seeing a bunch of shows, primarily there to see another show that had gotten a lot of interest. And he just happened to come by ours, NCR's, and went, wow. This is something special. So he wrote a great review for us. Prior to him even writing the review, Scott Murphy, a producer in New York, had come out and seen the show. And he was a big fan of David Cromer's direction. And so he wanted to bring it into New York even before we got a great review in the New York Times. And so we brought it into New York, and we put it up at the Minetta Lane Theater down in the Village, right by NYU. And it was a perfect show to be right by NYU because we had all those NYU students coming. And it's a really very cutting edge, very sort of modern, there's moments that are rock, there are moments that are jazz, there are moments that are symphonic. It's all over the map, but it's really interesting music. And because Josh Schmidt, the composer, has this background in underscoring theater, he never thinks of his composing as being the star of the show. He thinks of it as supporting the story. So I think he's ideal as a composer for theater. And the piece really, really came off well. So well that the New York Times called it the best new musical off Broadway that season. We got all kinds of awards. And
when was this?
About 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And and it was, you know, it was a huge hit down the Village, and all kinds of famous people came and saw it, and all kinds of people loved it. And some of the people that came to see it were the creators of Billy Elliot, the musical. Mm-hmm. And they contacted me through my agent and said, we would like you to come in and read for Billy Elliot. And I went in and I did a 45-minute audition for them, and I had a job the next week. And so the last week of Adding Machines Run, I was starting rehearsal for Billy Elliot. And so then...
And all because you did a favor for a friend.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And did it in this little tiny theater.
That's right. Because you never know.
You never know.
So that's a great story. That's a great story. So you wound up in New York, so now you're living in New York.
Yes. I you know, my wife was flying back and forth. She was, meanwhile, you know, acting back in Chicago. But she was done with that by the time I was done. And we thought, well, it looks like with Billy Elliot, we could be in New York for a while.
Yeah.
So we sold our house. And we moved to New York, and there's nothing like being in a hit Broadway show. So you see
everything.
Every great restaurant, you see every great place.
Well, and also, it's a terrific launch pad.
Yes.
And this, I'm not asking you this, but this too can be problematic for a marriage if
mm-hmm.
one of the people is mm-hmm. launching and the other is not.
It's a challenge. It's
yeah.
a challenge.
Yeah.
Now, I would go back to Chicago, I think, at some point, just so that we can have sort of our...
Your life back.
Yeah, and kind of our retirement years, both of us working with old friends.
Right.
Because
it's a support system.
It's a support system, and
yeah.
there is a community there in Chicago that's incredibly supportive, and we love dearly, and
you're a part of.
And we're a part of.
Yeah. And that sort of thing is, it's really irreplaceable. The sense that that you're conveying to me, that I feel from what you're saying, is that we belong there, we feel safe there, we feel that people will care for us there, that there's work because, in the same way that I did this for my friends because they were my friends, other people will do this for me.
Mm-hmm.
And as we get older, that stuff becomes even more and more important.
Also, in Chicago, I can go from doing Shakespeare
mm-hmm.
to doing musical theater.
To doing opera.
To whatever.
Right.
And that's dreamy to me.
Yeah. And not really available in New York.
No.
And even if you had started out there and had a career there, that stuff is still not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you're... you're a very lucky guy.
I am.
And yeah.
I get to work with Frank Galati, who I adore, and you know I've worked with in the past, and both Carol and myself, we just go home. We go, wow, that was a great day. We just had so much fun.
So just talk a little bit about the character that you're playing in My Fair Lady.
In any story, if a person is by themselves in a room and they do something outlandish, it's not outlandish because they're by themselves. If there's someone else in the room to bear witness to that behavior and maybe comment, maybe approve, maybe disapprove, then it becomes far more dramatically interesting. Colonel Pickering's job is to bear witness, along with Mrs. Pierce, the head housekeeper, to Henry Higgins' unfortunate life, you know, where he is so completely wrapped up in phonetics that he can't see human beings.
So now that's interesting because I thought you were going to say something else. You said that you know to bear witness to his unfortunate life. I thought you were going to say that they're there to bear witness to his evolution.
Well, he does maybe.
Yeah. Yes. Of course, you never know.
We never know.
No.
And that's what's kind of fun about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the perfect Hollywood ending, but it's. But the thing that he and Eliza Doolittle share is a passion for self-improvement.
Yes.
They both share that on a higher level than most people.
Yes.
And I think they find common ground there, and I think they find a kindred spirit there.
Boy, this is interesting. I would have said, but I'm... perfectly willing to be corrected. I would have said that she has this passion for self-improvement.
Mm-hmm.
He has a passion for...
improving others.
Yeah,
himself.
Right, I was going to say that. That's what I was going to say.
Yes.
Or being right. You know? I mean, once he gets involved in the possibility of improving her, that's a real passion for him. But
I think he cares about being right on some technical level, but on the bigger issues of the day that most of us care about, morality and things like
that.
Oh,
no, he doesn't care about that.
He could care less.
No, it's just in his area, what he knows.
Of expertise.
Of expertise, that's exactly right.
Yes.
And that is limiting the song, you know, I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face,
yes,
seems to suggest a terrific softening, a terrific awareness of his need for her.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear that, I mean, but then it's not, I mean, maybe I should just say that I buy that.
Mm-hmm.
Because then she gives him what he needs, which is deniability. Mm-hmm. She doesn't make him say it,
mm-hmm,
right?
And he also, I mean, he puts out to her that he wants a relationship that is not the old-fashioned idea of marriage that everybody thinks. There are no warm, fuzzy feelings about it going in.
Right.
It's going to be a battle.
See.
But it's going to be interesting.
Yes, and
and towards the end of the play, when he's at his mother's house,
yes,
and he says, and she's just really giving it to him, just a torrent.
Right.
And he says, I like you like this.
Yes.
He realizes for the first time how really important she is to him.
Yes. And how really special she
yeah
is.
She saw it miles ago.
Yeah.
And he's just getting a glimmer.
Right.
And
and of course you have Freddie, you know, who is a pushover for her. Which
yes,
is not what she wants.
And really, Freddie is kind of handy because Freddie is showing her what the options are.
Right.
The options in that world are chocolates and sweethearts and roses and lovely letters and
nothing
empty,
real.
Empty,
right.
Empty marriage.
Right. And that's yeah.
And he's really offering her more of a partnership and more of a. Is it dialectic? Is it a real?
No, it's an interaction. It's a relationship.
Yes.
Yes, it's a relationship in the best sense of
yes
the word.
Yes, it's a real conversation.
That's right. That's right. And as he, I suppose the real shift for him is going from, you know, we did it, to I see that you did it. I did it, you know, after the event, you know,
mm-hmm,
that he thinks, he can't even see that she did anything at all, you know, it's all, and Pickering also supports that, you know, you did it, and she...
That's the class.
That's right. To the moment where he says, I like you like this, because he sees, right, he sees it in her.
Yes.
Yeah.
He sees someone who is his equal.
Is his equal, right.
And that's the thing that had been...
Well, until then, I don't think he thought anybody was his equal.
Well, and then especially how he was raised. He was raised to believe a flower girl just is not to be even thought of as a human being.
Right, right.
And, you know, we're pushing towards that in our own country.
Aren't we? It's perfect.
Yeah.
Michael's so good at that, you know, choosing...
Michael, I did Inherit the Wind with him. At Indiana Rep years ago, and the thing that I thought was so brilliant about him as a director is everybody thinks of Inherit the Wind as the battle between these two giants,
right,
you know, Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan, and he, through the whole rehearsal process, made it about the community that was witnessing.
Wow, again, the witness.
Because he said, they're the ones that take the journey.
Yes.
They are the people that are of one opinion at the beginning and are another opinion at the end. And so their journey is the interesting journey.
Yeah, because the other guys don't change.
Yes.
How fascinating.
And because of that, the play had so much more dimension, so much more heart than just being this star turn between two bloviators.
Right. Ooh, that's great.
So, you know, yes, he gets.
Yeah, he does.
He gets...
Yeah, remember when I met you, I said that I thought he was a philosopher.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. With a heart.
With a heart. Absolutely. All right, so the question that I usually wrap up with is, you know, having given as many years as you have to this work, is there anything that you want to say about it, about what it means, what it feels like, anything at all about having spent a life, essentially?
Well, I think one of the major misconceptions about acting is that it's being really good at pretending to be someone else. But I think what the key to acting is finding the truth and telling the truth, whatever your character is. And I don't know many, I guess when you look back at me thinking about going to the seminary way back when, that has stayed on the same course, because that was what that was about.
The truth.
The truth.
Yes.
And
you couldn't really do that in the church.
I didn't feel like I could anymore.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's so wonderful. I mean, I believe I understand what you're saying, is that the initial drive for you was this thing about telling the truth, being the truth. And you thought you could do it in the church. And then you found that
it wasn't what it was about necessarily.
No. So, and you were so lucky to find a place where you could
where
do
I
the
could
truth.
Do that, yes. Oof. And both of them are involved in moving an audience from point A to point B.
Yes.
And that is, I think, the most wonderful feeling any human can have.
Yes. Having influence, having impact, making a difference. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love it. Yeah, and I've never heard anybody talk about it in quite this way, but I think you're exactly right. I like it. That's great. And a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Joel.
My pleasure.
So, being the truth, demonstrating the truth, telling the truth, that could be a definition of the Lynn Show, which, as you know, if you've been listening to the show or even just to the beginning of the show, is what is important to me, that we each find our own truth. And Joel Hatch's journey is a journey always towards a truth, believing that he could tell a kind of truth as a pastor in serving the community in a religious life, and then discovering that for him anyway, it was not so possible to tell a truth, to be the kind of truth that he wanted to be in that circumstance. And as I say towards the end of the interview, he was lucky enough not only to have the skills, but to have had theater popping up consistently in his life, almost as the universe saying, well, how about this then? How about this? And so when he found himself disappointed by his attempt to be the truth in a religious life, he had this other place to go where he can over and over again search for the truth of the character, to be what the character really is, and to have an influence, to have an impact, to move people from one place to another, to move an audience with the truth. It's very lovely. And we are grateful that that the religious life lost Joel, because if you have made it down or are making it down to see My Fair Lady at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida, which we'll be playing till the end of the month, you will see why we are grateful to have Joel Hatch on the musical theater stage. I need now to tell you, as I always do, about Josh Hackney, who is, I call him my IT guy, but he's much more than that. It was Josh who found the software that I am using to record this show as I am doing it right now. It was Josh who taught me how to use the software. It was and is Josh who shows up and corrects the sound for me and any other gaffes that I make. It was Josh who built me my current computer and entered in all of the software and shows me how to use what I used to think I knew how to use and no longer can. It is Josh who, when I forget how to upload a song from iTunes into this software, either comes and shows it to me or runs me through it on the phone. So any issues with computing, with web, with internet, with recording, with electronics, there is Josh Hackney. And I know that somebody listening needs this kind of help. And if you do, then it is Josh that you want to have helping you through it. And you can do that by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn because you will get something else entirely. thelynshow.com. Go to email me and say, I want to talk to Josh, and I will put you in touch with him. And as I said before, on my website, you can also have access to the book I wrote called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, which explains my version of why we get stuck, why we have trouble doing whatever it is that we think we want to do or need to do in our life, what stops us, and what we can do to unstop ourselves. And of course, the book has a chapter on cover story and undercover, which is what I think we come out of childhood with. A cover story which says who we think we are, and an undercover who says the rest of it. So you can get access to the book and the workbook and the audiobook, even listen to, I think, the beginning of the first chapter of the audiobook. You can read my article on phone therapy, because that is what I do these days. I talk to all my clients on the phone, so I have clients all over the country and sometimes out of the country. So if you're interested in therapy on the phone, you can read that article and you can email me. You can email me with questions about the book, about phone therapy, about the show, about any of the interviews, and all the interviews are up there. You can download them. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, and on LinkedIn. And if you like any of this, please do tell them on Facebook, LinkedIn, and or Twitter. And as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show. Something that interested you, compelled you, titillated you, started you thinking, amused you, something that will bring you back. Because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. But it ain't over yet, 'cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So